Chapter 23. Real circumstances of the applicant, that is, he had burst into tears outright and aloud, as a cornered woman will weep. The thin and polite gentleman, after contemplating her with an air of being struck all of a heap, abandoned his position under the cover of soothing remarks. She must not distress herself. The deed of the charity did not absolutely specify childless widows. In fact, it did not by any means disqualify her. But the discretion of the committee must be an informed discretion. One could understand very well her unwillingness to be a burden, etc., etc. Thereupon, to his profound disappointment, Mrs. Verloc's mother wept some more with an augmented vehemence. The tears of that large female in a dark, moldy wig, and ancient silk dress festooned with dingy white cotton lace, were the tears of genuine distress. As he had wept, because she was heroic, and unscrupulous and full of love for both her children. Girls frequently get sacrificed to the welfare of the boys. In this case she was sacrificing Winnie. By the suppression of truth she was slandering her. Of course, Winnie was independent, and need not care for the opinion of people that she would never see, and who would never see her, whereas poor Stevie had nothing in the world he could call his own except his mother's heroism and unscrupulousness. The first sense of security following on Winnie's marriage wore off in time, for nothing lasts, and Mrs. Verloc's mother, in the seclusion of the back bedroom, had recalled the teaching of that experience which the world impresses upon a widowed woman. But she had recalled it without vain bitterness. Her store of resignation amounted almost to dignity. She reflected stoically that everything decays, wears out, in this world. That the way of kindness should be made easy to the well-disposed, that her daughter Winnie was a most devoted sister, and a very self-confident wife indeed. As regards Winnie's sisterly devotion, her stoicism flinched. She accepted that sentiment from the rule of decay affecting all things human and some things divine. She could not help it. Not to do so would have frightened her too much. But in considering the conditions of her daughter's married state, she rejected firmly all flattering illusions. She took the cold and reasonable view that the less strain put on Mr. Verloc's kindness the longer its effects were likely to last. That excellent man loved his wife, of course, but he would, no doubt, prefer to keep as few of her relations as was consistent with the proper display of that sentiment. It would be better if its whole effect were concentrated on poor Stevie. And the heroic old woman resolved on going away from her children as an act of devotion, and as a move of deep policy. The virtue of this policy consisted in this: Mrs. Verloc's mother was subtle in her way, that Stevie's moral claim would be strengthened. The poor boy, a good, useful boy, if a little peculiar, had not a sufficient standing. He had been taken over with his mother, somewhat in the same way as the furniture of the Belgravian mansion had been taken over, as if on the ground of belonging to her exclusively. What will happen, she asked herself, for Mrs. Verloc's mother was in a measure imaginative, when I die? And when she asked herself that question it was with dread. It was also terrible to think that she would not then have the means of knowing what happened to the poor boy. But by making him over to his sister, by going thus away, she gave him the advantage of a directly dependent position. This was the more subtle sanction of Mrs. Verloc's mother's heroism and unscrupulousness. Her act of abandonment was really an arrangement for settling her son permanently in life. Other people made material sacrifices for such an object, she in that way. It was the only way. Moreover, she would be able to see how it worked. Ill or well, she would avoid the horrible incertitude on the deathbed. But it was hard, hard, cruelly hard. The cab rattled, jingled, jolted. In fact, the last was quite extraordinary. By its disproportionate violence and magnitude it obliterated every sensation of onward movement, and the effect was of being shaken in a stationary apparatus like a medieval device for the punishment of crime, or some very newfangled invention for the cure of a sluggish liver. It was extremely distressing, and the raising of Mrs. Verloc's mother's voice sounded like a wail of pain. I know, my dear, you'll come to see me as often as you can spare the time. Won't you? Of course, answered Winnie shortly, staring straight before her. And the cab jolted in front of a steamy, greasy shop in a blaze of gas, and in the smell of fried fish. The old woman raised a wail again. And, my dear, I must see that poor boy every Sunday. He won't mind spending the day with his old mother, Winnie screamed out stolidly. Mind? I should think not. That poor boy will miss you something cruel. I wish you had thought a little of that, mother. Not think of it. The heroic woman swallowed a playful and inconvenient object like a billiard ball, which had tried to jump out of her throat. Winnie sat mute for a while, pouting at the front of the cab, then snapped out, which was an unusual tone with her. I expect I'll have a job with him at first. He'll be that restless. Whatever you do, don't let him worry your husband, my dear. Thus they discussed on familiar lines the bearings of a new situation. And the cab jolted. Mrs. Verloc's mother expressed some misgivings. Could Stevie be trusted to come all that way alone? Winnie maintained that he was much less scent-minded now. They agreed as to that. It could not be denied. Much less hardly at all. They shouted at each other in the jingle with comparative cheerfulness. But suddenly the maternal anxiety broke out afresh. There were two omnibuses to take, and a short walk between. It was too difficult. The old woman gave way to grief and consternation. Winnie stared forward. Don't you upset yourself like this, mother. You must see him, of course. No, my dear. I'll try not to. She mopped her streaming eyes. But you can't spare the time to come with him, and if he should forget himself, and lose his way, and somebody spoke to him sharply, his name and address may slip his memory, and he'll remain lost for days and days. The vision of a workhouse infirmary for poor Stevie, if only during inquiries, wrung her heart. For she was a proud woman. Winnie's stare had grown hard, intent, inventive. I can't bring him to you myself every week, she cried. But don't you worry, mother. I'll see to it that he don't get lost for long. They felt a peculiar bump. A vision of brick pillars lingered before the rattling windows of the cab. A sudden cessation of atrocious jolting and uproarious jingling dazed the two women. What had happened? They sat motionless and scared in the profound stillness. Till the door came open, and a rough, strained whispering was heard. Here you are. A range of gabled little houses, each with one dim yellow window, on the ground floor, surrounded the dark open space of a grass plot planted with shrubs, and railed off from the patchwork of lights and shadows in the wide road, resounding with the dull rumble of traffic. Before the door of one of these tiny houses, one without a light in the little downstairs window, the cab had come to a standstill. Mrs. Verloc's mother got out first, backwards, with a key in her hand. Winnie lingered on the flagstone path to pay the cabman. Stevie, after helping to carry inside a lot of small parcels, came out and stood under the light of a gas lamp belonging to the charity. The cabman looked at the pieces of silver, which, appearing very minute in his big, grimy palm, symbolized the insignificant results which reward the ambitious courage and toil of a mankind whose day is short on this earth of evil. He had been paid decently for 1 shilling pieces, and he contemplated them in perfect stillness, as if they had been the surprising terms of a melancholy problem. The slow transfer of that treasure to an inner pocket demanded much laborious groping in the depths of decayed clothing. His form was squat and without flexibility. Stevie, slender, his shoulders a little up, and his hands thrust deep in the side pockets of his warm overcoat, stood at the edge of the path, pouting. The cabman, pausing in his deliberate movements, seemed struck by some misty recollection. Oh! Here you are, young fellow, he whispered. You'll know him again, won't you? Stevie was staring at the horse, whose hindquarters appeared unduly elevated by the effect of emaciation. The little stiff tail seemed to have been fitted in for a heartless joke, and at the other end the thin, flat neck, like a plank covered with old horse hide, drooped to the ground under the weight of an enormous bony head. The ears hung at different angles, negligently, and the macabre figure of that mute dweller on the earth steamed straight up from ribs and backbone in the muggy stillness of the air. The cabman struck lightly Stevie's breast with the iron hook protruding from a ragged, greasy sleeve. "Look here, young feller. How would you like to sit behind this ass up to 2 o'clock in the morning, perhaps?" Stevie looked vacantly into the fierce little eyes with red-edged lids. "He ain't lame," pursued the other, whispering with energy. "He ain't got no sore places on him. Here he is. How would you like?" His strained, extinct voice invested his utterance with a character of vehement secrecy. Stevie's vacant gaze was changing slowly into dread. "You may well look. Till 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. Cold and dry. Looking for fares. Drunks." His jovial purple cheeks bristled with white hairs, and like Virgil Silenus, who, his face smeared with the juice of berries, discoursed of Olympian gods to the innocent shepherds of Sicily, he talked to Stevie of domestic matters, and the affairs of men whose sufferings are great, and immortality by no means assured. "I am a night cabby, I am," he whispered, with a sort of boastful exasperation. "I've got to take out what they will blooming well give me at the yard. I've got my missus and 4 kids at home." The monstrous nature of that declaration of paternity seemed to strike the world dumb. A silence reigned during which the flanks of the old horse, the steed of apocalyptic misery, smoked upwards in the light of the charitable gas lamp. The cabman grunted, then added in his mysterious whisper, "This ain't an easy world." Stevie's face had been twitching for some time, and at last his feelings burst out in their usual concise form. "Bad. Bad." His gaze remained fixed on the ribs of the horse, self-conscious and somber, as though he were afraid to look about him at the badness of the world. And his slenderness, his rosy lips and pale, clear complexion, gave him the aspect of a delicate boy, notwithstanding the fluffy growth of golden hair on his cheeks. He pouted in a scared way like a child. The cabman, short and broad, eyed him with his fierce little eyes, that seemed to smart in a clear and corroding liquid. "Hard on asses, but damn sight harder on poor chaps like me," he wheezed just audibly. "Poor. Poor," stammered out Stevie, pushing his hands deeper into his pockets with convulsive sympathy. He could say nothing, for the tenderness to all pain and all misery, the desire to make the horse happy, and the cabman happy, had reached the point of a bizarre longing to take them to bed with him. And that, he knew, was impossible. For Stevie was not mad. It was, as it were, a symbolic longing, and at the same time it was very distinct, because springing from experience, the mother of wisdom. Thus when as a child he cowered in a dark corner scared, wretched, sore, and miserable with the black, black misery of the soul, his sister Winnie used to come along, and carry him off to bed with her, as into a heaven of consoling peace. Stevie, though apt to forget mere facts, such as his name and address for instance, had a faithful memory of sensations. To be taken into a bed of compassion was the supreme remedy, with the only one disadvantage of being difficult of application on a large scale. And looking at the cabman, Stevie perceived this clearly, because he was reasonable. The cabman went on with his leisurely preparations, as if Stevie had not existed. He made as if to hoist himself on the box, but at the last moment from some obscure motive, perhaps merely from disgust with carriage exercise, desisted. He approached instead the motionless partner of his labors, and stooping to seize the bridle, lifted up the big weary head to the height of his shoulder with one effort of his right arm, like a feat of strength. "Come on," he whispered secretly. Limping, he led the cab away. there was an air of austerity in this departure, the scrunched gravel of the drive crying out under the slowly turning wheels, the horse's lean thighs moving with ascetic deliberation away from the light into the obscurity of the open space beordered dimly by the pointed roofs, and the feebly shining windows of the little almshouses. The plaint of the gravel traveled slowly all round the drive. Between the lamps of the charitable gateway the slow cortege reappeared, lighted up for a moment, the short, thick man limping busily, with the horse's head held aloft in his fist, the lank animal walking in stiff and forlorn dignity, the dark, low box on wheels rolling behind comically with an air of waddling. They turned to the left. There was a pub down the street, within 50 yards of the gate. Stevie left alone beside the private lamppost of the charity, his hands thrust deep into his pockets, glared with vacant sulkiness. At the bottom of his pockets his incapable weak hands were clenched hard into a pair of angry fists. In the face of anything which affected directly or indirectly his morbid dread of pain, Stevie ended by turning vicious. A magnanimous indignation swelled his frail chest to bursting, and caused his candid eyes to squint. Supremely wise in knowing his own powerlessness, Stevie was not wise enough to restrain his passions. The tenderness of his universal charity had two phases as indissolubly joined, and connected as the reverse and obverse sides of a medal. The anguish of immoderate compassion was succeeded by the pain of an innocent but pitiless rage. Those two states expressing themselves outwardly by the same signs of futile bodily agitation, his sister Winnie soothed his excitement without ever fathoming its twofold character. Mrs. Verloc wasted no portion of this transient life in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.